Well, this guy helped coach Patrick Ewing in 92 in Barcelona at those Olympics. He was a part of that Dream Team staff. P.J. Carlissimo joins us now on The Fan, 680 and 93.7 FM. P.J., thanks for coming on this morning. How you doing?
I'm doing well, Nick and Chris. Good being with you. Appreciate it.
Appreciate it, P.J. Real quick, before we get to the 92 team, there has to be a reason why you're on the radar of the people who are actually putting that team together to be an assistant coach. I went back and I looked at it. I was living in New Jersey. I watched you coach at Wagner College, as a matter of fact, on Staten Island when I lived there.
You're dating yourself.
Yes, I am. Not you, me. I looked over. Hold on. These are the teams that you beat for maybe the most improbable run to a finals in the NCAA tournament's history. Because I know the history of what that team was as you built it up. You beat Utah, Kentucky, Kansas, UNLV, Indiana, and Duke to get to Michigan.
That's insane.
That's all in 1 year, where I think you guys were like 1-15 in the Big East, just basically a spit away from that season.
We had a good combination work, and I had excellent assistant coaches, obviously, but we did well recruiting internationally. We were a little ahead of the curve that way. We always had one or two international players, because when we first got to Seton Hall, we weren't able to keep the good local kids, the New York, New Jersey kids at home. And then finally, when we established we were capable of winning in the Big East Conference, we started keeping the good kids at home, and then it got easy. All of a sudden, we had really, really good players. And that group that you talk about, the 89 group, was we had, I think, seven seniors on that team. So we had guys who, as you said, got their heads knocked off when they were freshmen. I think they won two games in the conference. And then their sophomore year, they got to an NIT, which was the first time we'd been to a postseason tournament in a long time. And junior year, we got to the NCAAs for the first time in the school's history. And you guys would appreciate it. Our first game we play in the NCAA in the school's history, we're in Pauley Pavilion at UCLA, and we're playing, it was called UTEP then, but we're playing Texas Western, coached by Don Haskins. So it doesn't get much better in terms of, you want to play your first NCAA game, that's a pretty good place to play it, and there's not a better coach to go against than Don Haskins. So it was special. But that same group, when they were seniors, you know, a lot of experience, a lot of learning how to win eventually, and we just got on a run at a good time. It's really too bad. I mean, you know, so many things are more important than sports, but I was really looking forward to the tournament this year. I thought it was set up to be an excellent NCAA and one of the most open ones, and selfishly, I wanted to go to Il Localino when I came down to, I was looking to come into Atlanta and figured I could eat there three or four times in about 5 or 6 days. So I really missed that trip to Atlanta, as we've missed a lot of basketball right now.
P.J. Carlissimo with us, of course, having worked over at TNT, you know the lay of the land here in the city of Atlanta. Where to go?
I do. Thank you.
And the one other thing before we get to sort of the whole Dream Team and Michael Jordan and that thing, I just want to, the idea of losing a game in overtime by 1 point, I to this day, I remember the whistle blowing, and I'm sitting with a bunch of guys going, who's got the nerve to blow the whistle with 3 seconds left? But your guys handled themselves. I swear I remember this. Your guys handled themselves with an incredible amount of class at that post-game press conference.
Well, again, it was we had a veteran team, and you know what we told them when it was over. We couldn't change it. The guy who made the call, John Clockett, is not a good official. He's a great official. I mean, really, to be honest, in those days, you never knew who was reffing and what. You didn't have the, quote, transparency that you have nowadays. But, like, coming out on the floor, seeing him and Mickey Crowley and Tom Rucker, I'm, like, saying, wow, you know, you're not going to get a bad crew at a Final Four. It was a great crew. It was a unfortunate call. It really was. We would have liked to have seen Ramil just continue on. And I thought Ramil was going to end up, when you watch it, I think he would have hit Loy Vaught, and Loy Vaught would have taken a jump shot. But either Ramil or Loy Vaught takes a jump shot at the buzzer, and Michigan wins, or we win at the buzzer, and the players decide it. But it wasn't to be. And when we talked to the kids, there was not a lot of second guessing to do in the game. We did what we wanted to do. We played well. It was a heck of a game. The whole Final Four that year was a great Final Four. There were three really good games at the Final Four, and we just told the players, you know, Michigan didn't do anything wrong, and it wouldn't have been fair to, you know, start belly aching and crying about it and kind of take away a little bit from what Michigan had accomplished. And having a senior group and having the kind of kids we had, you know, they just bought in and they handled it, as you said, they handled it really well. It's funny, for a team that lost, they almost got more compliments than a lot of teams that won the national championship for exactly what you said, for the way they handled it.
P.J. Carlissimo with us here on The Fan, 680 and 93.7 FM. So you're still at Seton Hall in 92. How does the Dream Team connection happen for P.J. Carlissimo?
Well, I had spent a lot of time with USA Basketball. It was kind of, you know, looking back now, you know, everything kind of blends together. I've done a lot. But even at that point, I had coached a number of USA teams. I'd been a floor coach at the Olympic Trials in 88. I had coached the World University Games in 91. I'd been an assistant coach in 90 with Mike Kay, both in the Goodwill Games out here in Seattle, where I live now, and also in the World Championships, it was called in those days, in Buenos Aires. So I'd spent a lot of time with USA Basketball, and Mike Krzyzewski, who was the other, quote, college assistant on that team, Mike and I were chosen up until this current staff right now, when they made the decision to go to NBA players, the guidelines were that there would be two NBA coaches and two college coaches, and Chuck Daly was selected as the first coach, and Lenny Wilkins was the other NBA coach on that team, and Mike and I were picked as the college guys, if you will, because we'd spent a lot of time, even at that point, coaching USA Basketball, and we had a lot of experience in international basketball, and so we were lucky enough to be chosen, and ended up, you know, being a part of just an incredible summer. It's hard to overstate what a great summer that was, how enjoyable it was getting to know some. I knew about half of the team from either they played against us in the Big East, or I knew them well from Nike coaches' trips. We'd go on coaches' trips, and four or five of the NBA guys who were Nike players, endorsers, would come. Michael Jordan always came on a trip, Charles Barkley, David Robinson, Danny Rowfield from down your way, and you know, there were certain players who came on the trip every year, and you know, I had coached against Michael and Patrick and Chris in college, knew them for a long time through the Nike connection also, so it was fun, but there were other guys, Larry Bird, Karl Malone, John Stockton, I'd never even met them. And obviously became great friends. You spent a lot of time with people in experience like that. So it was just phenomenal. We were very, very lucky. And Mike went on, of course, and you know, eventually became the first college guy to be a head coach in the Olympics with the NBA players. And he and another buddy, Jim Boeheim, and I, who had assisted Mike back in 90, in the World Championships, those two guys had an amazing run of three gold medal Olympic performances.
I think a lot of people are fascinated by those Dream Team practices, every bit as much as the Bulls run, which is the main topic. We'll ask about that in a second. But after 88, when you find out as a college guy, they're not going to have the college guys play in the Olympics anymore, do you remember what your initial reaction was to
Dream Team? I was upset because I thought it was an overreaction from not winning in 88. We didn't, you know, there was a lot of criticism. It was a good team. I still believe, Hersey Hawkins doesn't get hurt, I still believe we win the gold medal in 88. But it clearly was a time, the Soviet team in 88 and the Yugoslavia team that won the world championships in 90, were the best international teams we had ever played against. Even but luckily, I was coaching in Europe back in 72. I was actually at the Russia-U.S. game, the very famous game in 72. But the best teams internationally I thought that we ever competed against were the Soviet team that had Arvydas Sabonis, Šarūnas Marcinonis, Sasha Volkov, who played in Atlanta, you know, all those guys. And then the 90 team, when it was still Yugoslavia before it split up, Croatia and Serbia. That team had a lot of the same guys we played against. You saw it in the Michael Jordan episode. But, you know, it had Tony and Drazen and Dino Raja. I mean, just an unbelievable team. And they just felt, hey, we can't compete anymore. And as a college coach, and particularly with all the success we had had, I resented it. But it was the correct decision. It was great. You know what it was great for? It was great for basketball. Obviously, it was good for the U.S. in terms of competition-wise. But by that point, everybody was admitting that these players from the elite leagues, from Greece and Spain and Italy and France, and they were professional players. Turkey, those guys were professional players. And we had young amateurs competing against professional players. And it was also those teams stayed together. You know, the national teams in Russia, it was the same roster, essentially. You know, you'd play one Olympics 4 years later, you'd play the same team, and 9 or 10 of the guys were guys who had already been not only on the prior Olympic team, they'd been playing together in the under-16s, under-18s, and the combination of international basketball improving so much and these teams being together and us throwing a team together, as we often do, you know, like one summer and you have guys who really never played with each other, it got a little bit tougher. So it was a good decision. It was a great decision for basketball, but I hated it as a college coach.
P.J. Carlissimo with us here on the Fan, 680 and 93.7 FM. So I'm sure you're watching The Last Dance like the rest of us. Those scrimmages in Monte Carlo, as a coach, are you just staying out of the way and you're essentially a fan watching? How much coaching is actually going on when those guys are going at one another?
Well, there clearly wasn't a lot of coaching. Unfortunately for me, I was doing a little bit of reffing. I'll try and do the quick backstory. Two things. First of all, that was the first time we scrimmaged against each other. There was 4 segments to that summer. First segment was practices in La Jolla, San Diego. We practiced there at UCSD. That's where we had our first practices for a week. And when we practiced there, we had a college all-star team, for lack of a better term. It's been replaced actually by the select team. When Pop gets his group together next summer, there'll be a team of like 10 or 12 of the best young NBA players to scrimmage against before the national team goes to the Olympics. And so we had a college team to play against. And it was a great play. It was like Bobby Hurley, Penny Hardaway, Chris Webber, Grant Hill. I mean, you know, tremendous. Most of them went out and became NBA All-Stars. Roy Williams and George Raveling coached that team. So every time we scrimmaged against them. We went to Portland because we had to qualify. We hadn't won in 88. And we tournament of the Americas. All we did was play games. We played like 6 games in 8 days, so we never practiced when we were in Portland. And we finally got to a week of practice in Monte Carlo before we went to Barcelona. And that was the first time. It was like, hey, we're going to scrimmage. We do our drills. You know, Chuck worked on offense, defense, whatever we were doing. Now it's the end of practice. We're going to scrimmage for 45 minutes or an hour. And guess what? We got 12 guys there. And so now that's the first time we really went 5-on-5 against each other. And it didn't matter, you know, how you drew it up. John Stockton was a little dinged up that summer, as was Larry Bird. So there were a couple days where we only had 10 healthy guys or 10 guys who could go for, you know, a good chunk of the scrimmage. So it would be 5-on-5. And you know, when Stock was out, the only other 2 guys who could play point on that team were Irvin Magic Johnson, and Michael was the point guard for the other team. So that was that matchup. And then you had at center, you had Patrick Ewing going against David Robinson. You had Charles Barkley going against Karl Malone at the 4 spot. And the wing players were like, you know, Scottie Pippen, Chris Mullin, Clyde Drexler. So, I mean, whatever matchup you had, whatever way you split it up, obviously it was like world-class games. And the mindset of those guys, obviously you're talking Hall of Famers, you're talking NBA All-Stars, NBA MVPs, world champions. The pride factor and the competitiveness of that group didn't matter whether it was a drill or a 5-on-5 game to 11 in a basically empty gym in Monte Carlo. The competition was incredible. I mean, I always likened it to, remember when you used to play on a playground when you were young and it was like, you know, game is 11 and, you know, winners stay, the loser off the court. And, it got to be point game. If somebody had a layup, you just push him in the back. Like, you weren't going to let him score, you know, take it out of bounds. If you're going to win, you got to win on a legit shot. Well, we had that same dynamic going in Monte Carlo. The only difference was it was the best players in the world, you know, grabbing each other and screaming at each other and barking at the refs. And I had actually suggested to Chuck talking about, you know, all the years we had already coached internationally at that time. I said, you know, Chuck, they're going to see some officiating like they've never seen in their lives. I mean, he's got the officials, particularly in those days, it was even worse, had never seen people like our players with the quickness and the ability to play above the rim. And they just weren't that good. And I said, our players are going to wig out. We get to Barcelona and these guys start making travel calls or goal to, you know, like things because they're overwhelmed by the talent. And so we brought in an Italian official, of course. We had to do that with Cellini and Carlesimo and Domino for sure. Mm-hmm. So we had one Italian official and one French official. I think it lasted one day because, again, when it got competitive, they made their calls. They were terrible calls, and the players are screaming at them. And Chuck said, all right, you're right. You made your point, but these guys can't work. Get them out of here. And I ended up actually, we had the coaches having to put the whistles on. You wouldn't have watched that closely, but if you saw a crazy guy with a beard in the middle of those Monte Carlo scrimmages, that's me with a whistle around my neck.
And, so were you the reason Magic Johnson threw a basketball 40 rows into a stands?
I don't think I was the reason, but Matt, you know, we had a group of us, eight of us, including Chuck and Rod Thorne and Charles, and Charles wasn't every day, Michael was, that after practices or after shoot-arounds, we would immediately go and golf. And the golf course at Monte Carlo was way up on top of the hill. I hate to say it was actually the road that Princess Grace was killed on. I mean, a horrendous road, beautiful golf course, way up on top of the mountain that overlooks Monte Carlo. You can imagine what the views were like from up there. But we would go up and golf. So anytime I made a call against Irvin's team, he would start chirping to Michael, go, oh, you got your caddy ref in the game. No wonder you're getting all the calls and stuff like this. So it was, there was a lot of trash talking. It wasn't usually that friendly. I mean, they really got after it. And we were in the middle of it oftentimes, to be honest with you, because the officials that we had brought in to acquaint the players with international officiating lasted one day. And players were so upset that we just moved on from it. And that great basketball and that unbelievable competition when these guys were going 5-on-5 against each other, that literally was the best basketball played that summer.
Finishing up with P.J. Carlesimo, I got to go back to 72. You are there in Munich when the ending happens against the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
What's going on inside of that arena? Just disbelief, stunned silence?
Yeah, people had no idea because they put them back on the floor twice, I think. I mean, it's unbelievable. The documentary on it was really done well. But, I mean, you had no idea. You thought you won. They put them back out there. It didn't work second time. They put them back out there again, and then they finally make the long pass. Belov catches it and goes up and shoots it, and it's over. And, like, you're just shaking your head going, I can't believe it. And, you know, my seats were good. They weren't great. But, like, you could see, I mean, the guys were stunned. You had Hank Iba. I think Coach Bach might have been an assistant on that team, too. I think he was, Johnny Bach. But the players, prior to that, I had spent a lot of time in the village with the guys. I mean, Doug Collins was a good friend, Kevin Joyce, Mike Bantam, guys that were on that team. And then, obviously, you remember what happened with the Israel, this situation when they came in and terrorists came in and took over the village. So it went from being where we were involved and with the players every day to then the village was just locked up so tight you couldn't even get near the competitors anymore. And so we weren't there, so you weren't able to interact as much. You know, after the first couple games, we would be talking to the guys and everything. Everything was wide open. But by the time they got to the gold medal game, it was actually postponed a few days. By the time we got to the gold medal game, I never got to really talk to those guys there in Munich, but I mean, they were absolutely stunned.
Never collected their medals.
It was a circus. Oh no, they refused to.
Yeah, they were in a vault somewhere.
You want to get Doug Collins going sometime? Ask him about the game. But no, it was unbelievable. But in fact, I would say almost to a man or woman, every person in the arena had no idea what was going on because I mean, they kept trying to finish the game. It was bizarre. It really was.
PJ, we only have a couple minutes left. Can we go through a couple of things pretty quickly?
Sure.
Have you ever gambled with Michael, played cards, played golf? I'm assuming when you're playing golf with him in Monte Carlo or any place.
Those Nike trips and, you know, no question. He does not have a gambling problem. There's no question about that. And doesn't have a competitive problem either. He wants to win at everything, every day. It's what fuels him, and it's phenomenal. He's a tremendous competitor on a golf course, at a poker table, where, you know, blackjack, whatever you're doing. So yeah, I've spent it, been really fortunate to spend a lot of time with him, and a ton of fun.
I think I know the answer beforehand, but coaches don't receive medals. I don't know. Do you get something if you
We got a beautiful ring. Yeah, we got a beautiful ring, and I think after the fact, USA Basketball gave us a watch too. But a beautiful ring given by, again, by USA Basketball, not by. It's kind of funny because everybody, you know, probably wrongly so, everybody knows who the coaches are for a team like basketball. Like, if I ask you who the swimming coach was or who the track and field coach, most times you have no idea, and everybody just assumes, well, those guys don't get medals. And, you know, we came back and everybody said, let me see your medal. I said, hey, coaches don't get medals. The 12 players got medals, and we enjoyed it. It was great. I have a beautiful ring from that, but no medals for the coaches. And, you know, in all the other sports, people would expect that. People are surprised in basketball, but that's the way it is. We're the same as all the other sports.
I don't know how many times you've been asked to do, see Michael on the floor in 92 the way that you did. Is it easy to say he's the greatest player you've ever seen?
Easy for me, yeah. Completely easy for me, and I think a lot of people now seeing him are like going, wow. You know, it's funny, those of us have been in it so long, I'm over 40 years with, but the younger generation didn't see him play. A lot of guys are seeing him play now, even young players in the league, and I'm sure they're going, wow, I didn't know he was this good. To me, no comparison.
Wanted to circle back around to college basketball. You said you were looking forward to coming down to the Final Four. You thought the tournament would have been wide open. It's kind of a general question to ask, but how do you save college basketball? How do you regain the interest that once was there?
I think the interest will be there. I don't like the way it's going with the NBA is doing their G League I'm going to call it experiment, because they're letting the player. What they're trying to do is stop the players from going to Australia or China or Japan instead of going to the to college for 1 year. I really am disappointed by the, when people talk about these guys going to school for 1 year, and they attach no value whatsoever to going to school for a year and hopefully getting a leg up on getting a degree. And it's getting a lot tougher to coach in college than it used to. I talked about that team we had way beginning of this interview, having seniors together for 4 years, and how good. You hardly see that. And there are some. There are some schools, Gonzaga is one of them, that does a good job keeping their guys there. But the one-and-dones are so hard to coach, and it's so hard to get some continuity. And, you know, you got a lot of programs, obviously, still doing a good job with it. But I think it will still be there. I think there's still going to be interest in college basketball. I think it's great. But there's no comparison to the teams nowadays and the teams that were playing like, you know, 20, 30 years ago. Those teams that were together and had the best players. Like Michael stayed in college for 3 years. I mean, those teams were just better basketball teams. They had more talent, and they've watered down. There's too many young guys coming in the NBA, and they're not ready for the NBA.
And the Big East had three Final Four participants, to let you know what that conference was all about as well, because a lot of those guys rolled into seniors, guys like Chris Mullin and a few others. I do want to finish up with this. For all you've done and accomplished, do you want to become a bigger hero in the city of Atlanta? Because I'm sure you know there are a lot of people here. You don't sit on the fence when it comes to Duke. You either love them or you absolutely loathe them. You cannot stand anything. I think you might have administered, and by the way, you work with Mike the next year.
Yeah.
I think you might have administered the biggest turnaround beatdown in the history of Mike Krzyzewski's career in a really, really important game.
Well, we were lucky. We were a little nervous. That was the only time that whole year you talked about the teams we had beaten. That was the only time we were nervous. I think we were down 26-8 to start. Fortunately, we had a lot of time to get it turned around, and you know, once we got it sorted out, and we kind of warmed down. We were deep. We had a lot of players, and Danny Ferry, who was the best player in college basketball that year, frankly, just got exhausted. We just kept throwing bodies at him, and he carried them early, and not that he wasn't a good player late in the game, but we had more good players than they did. That was the difference. It just took us a while.
Well, that's the semifinal game. You had a 35-point swing in that game against the Duke.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was an incredible game, and the other two game, the Michigan Illinois game in the semi was a great game, and then obviously a 1-point game in the championship game. It was really an entertaining Final Four. A lot of people, you know, said sitting there watching the three games, you got your money's worth. There were three pretty good basketball games.
Well, PJ, fascinating stuff. Stay safe. Hopefully we can sit down and have some dinner in town when all is said and done.
I'm there for sure. I'm taking you to Localino, and Chris and Nick, great being with you.
Thank you, PJ. Really appreciate it.